On March 8, 1998, 17-year-old Oscar Eagle was shot in the leg in Los Angeles's Pico Union neighborhood. 6 days later, 16-year-old Benjamin Urias was also shot, a non-fatal wound that police believed was in retaliation for Oscar's shooting. Soon, police arrested Oscar Eagle, but the charges were dropped when Urias failed to appear in court. Then something changed. Urias suddenly became confident that Oscar was the shooter, even though he'd always said the gunman had run to and from the car. But with Oscar's debilitating leg injury, could he really have done that? This is Wrongful Conviction. The Fox Foundation is proud to support this episode of Wrongful Conviction and the work of After Innocence, a nonprofit that helps hundreds of people nationwide rebuild their lives after wrongful incarceration. Each year, innocent people are released after spending years behind bars for crimes they didn't commit. Nearly all of them leave prison with nothing more than the clothes on their backs, with no help or compensation from the state as they face the steep challenges of rebuilding their lives after wrongful imprisonment. After Innocence is changing that. After Innocence helps exonerees get and make good use of essential services like healthcare, dental care, mental health support, legal aid, financial counseling, and more. Since 2016, they've brought that help to more than 800 exonerees across 46 states, working tirelessly to ensure that no one released after wrongful incarceration is left behind. Learn more at after-innocence.org and join After Innocence to support exonerees as they rebuild their lives. Welcome back to Wrongful Conviction. I'm your host, Lauren Bright Pacheco, and I'm so glad to be back for another season. And we're starting off in Los Angeles in the late 1990s, a time defined by gang hysteria and the sweeping mass incarceration that followed. Joining me today is someone who lived through it as a kid, Oscar Eagle. Oscar, welcome.
Thank you.
And to help tell the story, his attorney from California Innocence Advocates, Megan Baca. Welcome.
Thank you.
So, Oscar grew up in the 80s and the 90s in the Pico Union area of Los Angeles.
I had two loving parents. I had a sister that lived with me, and I had a brother that was in and out of juvenile hall camp, and he was a lot older than me. He was about 10 years older than me. Yeah, so the family life was comfortable. My dad, after work, he came straight home and we ate at the dinner table or in the living room. It was a good time growing up in the house. But outside of my house was the projects in the Pico Union,
which was the main hangout for a gang called the Burlington Locos.
So I witnessed them growing up, looking out my window, watching them, you know, writing on the walls. And I love art. You know, I love drawing. And probably like 10 years old, I got into graffiti. That habit continued when I got involved with gangs.
Oscar's graffiti tag was clown, and graffiti really was the extent of his criminal activity.
I believe that drew a lot of attention to me. Growing up in Pico Union, I was always getting harassed by these cops. At one time when I was younger, the LAPD pulled probably about five of us from in front of my house. And after the cops left, all my friends, they started to leave. I went back in my house. But in front of my house, some other kids that lived in the neighborhood that were not gang members, they gathered up like about four or five Christmas trees and they put it on fire. And the police showed up. They took a guess and said, oh, well, Oscar was just hanging out in front of the house right here. They arrested me and were saying that they watched me from across the street burning the Christmas trees.
So this was the first time that Oscar's alleged gang affiliation led to false charges against him. In Los Angeles at the time, there was a specialized unit called CRASH, short for Community Resources Against Street Hoodlums. But as we've seen in other cities with heavy gang policing, when a neighborhood is associated with a gang, an alleged member of the area's gang will usually be targeted for any crime that occurs in the area, innocent or not. And most gang members aren't involved in violent crime at all, like graffiti artists, but they are painted with the same broad criminal brush.
That's absolutely right. You know, if every gang member was violent, man, it would be super chaotic out there. But it's only a small percentage of every gang that has these type of individuals that are violent, like sociopaths or whatever, you know.
So while on probation, Oscar was targeted again while at his friend Victor's house. There was a party going on outside when LAPD raided the location.
An officer put the flashlight on me, and I heard him say to another officer that that clown is right here. That's what they used to call me, clown. And they cut me up, and they told me that I was being arrested for violating my probation for hanging around with Victor, who is a Burlington gang member. So they cut me up. They threw me in that cop car. Soon as we left 18th and Union, we headed down towards Venice and Union, and a guy named Juan Carlos and Martha Torres crossing the street. And Juan Carlos was a gang member from Drifters. They cuffed him up. They opened up the trunk of the car, and they pulled something out of the car. It was a bag of something. I don't know if it was marijuana or what, but they say, you're going to get arrested for this, you know? He said, that shit ain't mine. And they're like, get in the car. And there was two 18th Street gang members crossing the street. They pulled up on them, chased them on foot. They grabbed a hold of a guy named Weddle and another guy. I don't know what the other guy's name was. And they threw them in the cop car with us, went to the police station. It was a lot of activity going on that day. It was a lot of cops everywhere. There was a lot of people in there. They were interested in the guy from 18th Street, the guy named Weddle. They started talking to him, and they were bragging about they killed somebody that looked just like him.
And then crash unit officer Nino Durden threatened Oscar with firearm charges.
Officer Durden, he threw me in a room and started to tell me that I was going to go down for some guns. And like, I guess he wanted me to admit to the guns or something like that. And I was like, nah, I'm not going to do that, man. Like, man, you got me for violation probation. Just take me in a ruddy. And I went to juvenile hall, actually got convicted for the gun charge. I got out of camp around October of 1997, I believe. I was trying to be more mature at that time. I kept my routine up, exercising, going to school, going to my community service. And on March 8th, it was my niece's birthday. We celebrated her birthday at my house. After that party, boredom set in, and I said, you know what, I'm gonna go to Picunyunyan. I took the bus to Picunyunyan, and I started walking, looking for the guys, and I couldn't find anybody from the neighborhood. So I started walking towards the bus stop on Picunyunyan to go home in East LA. And so when I was walking over there, a car pulled up and started shooting at me, and immediately it hit me in my calf.
Oscar turned 18 2 days after he was shot. And the wound made it very difficult for him to walk, let alone run, which became a very important fact on March 14th, when a 16-year-old kid named Benjamin Urias was also shot.
So Urias was a 16-year-old kid who was just walking in the Pico Union neighborhood of Los Angeles, and a car pulled up. He says that somebody jumped out of the back seat, yelled Burlington Locos, which is the name of the local gang and one that Oscar was associated with. He says that the shooter took off running, which is important, chased after Urias. Urias went to hide under a nearby vehicle. Ultimately, several shots went off and one grazed Urias's chest and another his leg. And then the shooter ran back to the car again. Important considering that Oscar was incapable of running.
Because you're on crutches, right? It went into your calf. The bullet was still lodged there.
Yeah, it was still lodged right there.
And Urias originally told responding officers that the shooter was wearing shorts. Oscar also had a drain on his leg where the blood was draining out from the bullet wound. And Urias said that he didn't notice anything on the shooter's leg. Well, this drain would have been very visible.
But despite these disqualifying elements, they contacted Oscar under the auspices of his own debilitating shooting.
March 15, I get a call from Detective Caceres. And I go, I told you guys already that I didn't see who shot me. I don't have nothing else to say to you guys. He goes, well, we need to close that case up and we need you to pretty much like sign off on it or something like that. And then on March 17, he showed up right away, looked at my leg and seen that I was on crutches. And he's like, hey, you can't walk. And I go, nah, could you put your foot to the floor? And I said, nah, my calf locked and I wasn't able to stretch my leg or nothing. He told me, hey, you know, Junior from 18th Street. And I was like, no. And he goes, well, he knows you.
The guy he's calling Junior is Benjamin.
Yes. And I was like, maybe I do know him. I don't know. I grew up right there in Pico Union. Maybe I don't know him personally. Maybe we see each other around. So he's like, well, he's saying that you shot him. I was like, I don't know what you're talking about. So he was like, I don't think you did because I'm looking at your leg and I don't think you're capable of doing this crime.
It later became clear that neither did the victim, Benjamin Urias, but Oscar was affiliated with the Burlington Locos. So they brought him in anyway, and he told them exactly where he was during the shooting, at the hospital with his friend Becky Chavez, whose friend Susie had gone into an early and false labor.
I went to the hospital all day. I remember going back and forth to drink water. I remember the camera being right above the water fountain. And then the security, I remember him being a short black officer. So I was like, go talk to that security guard. Go get the camera right there. And they didn't do none of that. They called Becky Chavez, who I was with that night. So she got down there. They put Becky in a room. They questioned her. And she just verified the same thing that I told them. And they came out. And they put me in front of her. And they asked me, hey, you better say you did it. Because if not, Becky Chavez is going to go down for this too. And I was like, man, why are you doing this to us? She told me, like, don't listen to these cops, you know? So I told Becky, hey, Becky, sorry, you're going to have to get arrested too because, you know, I didn't do this crime. And then I seen her walk out. And then it took me a week or two to get a public defender to come visit me at the LA County. One of the first things I told him, man, go get the footage from the hospital. And my first two courts, I was going in crutches. And then on the third court day, the case got dismissed.
Because Junior didn't show up.
That he didn't show up.
In order to indict Oscar again, they were going to need the victim's cooperation. But there's a recording of this new interaction with Ben Urias, which appears to shed light on why he hadn't shown up to the prior court proceedings and also why he was now open to suggestion.
So we don't have a recording of the first lineup and we don't know precisely what happened there, but it's really clear from the recording of the second lineup that police definitely pushed Urias into selecting Oscar.
Urias also repeatedly asked if they were going to help him on his other case, and six times the new detectives, Murrell and Wiseman, assured him they'd get him on home confinement instead of juvenile camp. Interestingly, these new detectives were from the homicide unit, even though this wasn't a homicide. They asked Urias if he knew his shooter's name, and Urias said, quote, "They said Oscar Eagle." Then he's shown a lineup. With Oscar in position 4, Urias denied recognizing his shooter. Detective Murrell urged him, quote, "Take a closer look at it there." Again, Urias didn't make an identification. Silence. Then Urias says, quote, "Looks, sort of looks." Murrell cut him off, quote, "Like number 4.
And then Urias says the number that they had pointed to, that the police pointed to in the lineup. I don't know why they were so focused on Oscar or why police didn't bother investigating other alternative suspects, but it seems that once they had their eyes set on Oscar, they just weren't going to take anything else other than Oscar.
So, you know, just to show how crazy this was, at the time of your trial, forget about Becky, they've pulled in another woman randomly, a young woman named Martha Torres. She was 20 years old, just happened to be from the neighborhood. And now they're claiming that she was driving the car that you were in the night Junior was shot. And now they twist it so that the motive is that you're shooting Junior in retaliation for you being shot, and that Torres is motivated by the fact that her brother was murdered by a member of the same rival gang. And none of it's true.
And her brother was not even a Burlington gang member. Her brother was from another different gang called Drifters, but they made it seem like he was from my neighborhood too. And I was like, oh man, this guy's not even from my neighborhood.
And then the saddest part is she, like you, is completely innocent, but they talk her into taking a plea deal
for 5 years.
Yeah. Ms. Torres, I think, made the right decision, unfortunately, even though she was innocent, because she was facing life as well. I mean, she could have ended up doing more than 26 years like Oscar as well. So she began trial with Oscar, and partway through the beginning of trial, she separately took a plea deal, and the judge had to instruct the jury that they weren't supposed to draw any conclusions by Ms. Torres no longer being part of Oscar's trial. You know, Ms. Torres still maintains her innocence, and there was no evidence against her. She had never driven. She didn't have a driver's license. She didn't know how to drive. Her friend's father happened to own a vehicle that looked similar to the one Arias described. That's it.
So Martha Torres did the math and did not like her odds, but Oscar's appointed attorney, Patrick Lake, gave him confidence.
He started to tell me that he talked to my alibis. He talked to my doctor. He said that they all confirm and verify my story and that we're good and we got a strong case right here. And also the judge that we're going to be in front of is a friend from school or something like that.
But it seems like Patrick Lake had given Oscar false confidence.
So at trial against Oscar, there was the testimony of Benjamin Arias, and by the time of trial, he was much more confident that it was Oscar. He wasn't cross-examined thoroughly. It seems that maybe Oscar's defense counsel hadn't listened to the audio recorded police interview, because if he had, then it's inexplicable why he wouldn't have cross-examined him on the inconsistencies that Arias didn't originally pick out Oscar, that the police directed him to pick out Oscar. In fact, they said, how about this one?
He's still quiet. He's still quiet. And I was like, what the hell? Like, you're not going to speak for me? And then I told him, hey, is the doctor going to show up? And he goes, oh, he'll be here tomorrow.
There was that. There was testimony from police officers, including, you know, gang investigators, which is scary for the jury to hear about gang members in their community.
I had two tattoos. So when I was in trial, they had like poster size pictures that Stephanie Barr took the stand and started saying, oh, these are old English type letters. And, you know, she started telling professional opinion. I was like, oh, this they're just trying to use any little thing just
anything they could do to make you look bad.
Just look like an animal. And Patrick Lake, he doesn't talk again. And I'm like, hey, man, what's going on, man? He's like, oh, I'm preparing. And it's not. So I told him, hey, what's up with the doctor? Is he showing up? And he said, yeah, he'll be here tomorrow. I said, you told me that yesterday. Every day he kept telling me that. And the next thing you know, the case is almost over with. And I'm like, hey, where's the doctor at? Oh, he's not going to show up.
It sounds like your representation didn't prepare at all. You only had one witness called in your defense, and that was Becky. I'm going to throw it to you, Megan. When you looked into the witnesses that Patrick Lake claimed to have contacted for his defense, what did you find?
Well, we spoke to the friend that had false labor that day that Oscar went to go see in the hospital, and she absolutely remembered this day. She was in the hospital for false labor, so that's documented. She said Patrick Lake had never interviewed her or her mother, and when Patrick Lake said that he left a message on their answering machine, she says they didn't even have an answering machine back then, that she absolutely would have appeared at trial had she been called to do so, but she wasn't even interviewed. Quite simply, he didn't interview witnesses. He didn't call these witnesses that were so crucial. And then, in fact, it's very apparent that he lied to the court about having interviewed these witnesses. You know, he stood up, he looked around court and said, I don't see them here. I don't know why they're not here to testify. Well, because he hadn't bothered to even talk to them.
And then at one point, I think the judge said, we'll give you 20 more minutes.
So even when the judge gave an additional 20 minutes, even if Patrick had called then, she would have been completely unprepared. She probably, in LA, she wouldn't even be able to get to the courthouse in that amount of time.
My mom passed me a note that morning. She said, fire your lawyer. Like, this guy ain't doing nothing for you. He didn't even contact your alibis. I raised my hand and the judge was like, what are you doing? And I said, man, I want to fire this guy. And he's like, wait, hold on. And he took everybody out the courtroom. And he said, you're doing a Marson motion or something like that? And I was like, I don't know what that is. I just want to fire this guy because he hasn't been representing me. And he goes, oh, you just don't like the way your trial's going. And so you just want to get rid of your lawyer? He goes, it doesn't work that way. You know, sit back down. So I was like, man, let me take the stand then. I was like, man, at least let me show the jurors, because they're going to see the hole in my leg and they're going to be like, oh, man, this guy wasn't able to do this crime. As soon as I got up on that stand, I just felt attacked by the DA. And then next thing you know, it was go sit back down. So I turned around and told the judge, hey, judge, can I show my leg to the jurors? He said, nah, go back and sit down.
Patrick Lake could have asked to show that to the jury, but Oscar, as the witness at that time, can't just turn around and ask the judge, hey, let me show my leg.
And then a detective takes a stand. He holds up two pictures. One is you holding a gun, no context of where or when it was taken. The other one is you standing next to somebody holding a gun. And on March 12th, 1999, you were convicted of attempted first-degree murder and sentenced to life in prison plus 25 years.
At that moment, you know, I was stoic and shocked. I didn't know how to react, but I just remember my mother, she was right behind me. Yeah, I just heard her cry. When I heard her cry, I turned around. And the judge was talking, and I didn't hear nothing at all. I just my mother. I was feeling the emotions that she was feeling, you know, like they're separating us for life. My mom had stopped drinking when I was probably about 12, 13 years old. She made me a promise that she wasn't going to drink no more. And after I got convicted, I started hearing that she was drinking. And I was like, what the hell? Like, and I knew it was because of me.
Because of what was done to you.
Yeah.
You then end up entering California's adult prison system as a teenager.
I got there at 19 years old. I didn't know how to cell live. At that time, it was 24-hour lockdowns, sometimes going years and years lockdown. It was a violent, it was riots. When I got there to Pelican Bay, there was a big riot in February of 2000. And I ended up going to the ADSEG for that for 16 months. And then I ended up in Ironwood State Prison. I found a good program right there. You know, I completed a computer class and I started having a porter job. And I always been drawing. You know, that was my hustle. I used to tell my mom, don't send me money. Just buy me my art supplies and I'll figure out how to get money.
While Oscar's early appeals failed, the LAPD was still reeling from what became known as the Rampart Scandal. It began with a 1997 road rage incident, but exploded the following summer when crash unit officer Rafael Perez was caught stealing cocaine from an evidence locker and selling it, nearly $800,000 worth. To save himself, Perez turned state's witness and became a whistleblower, exposing everything Oscar had already experienced and more. Brutality, planted evidence, perjury, drug trafficking, bank robbery, cover-ups, and even ties to organized crime. Perez also revealed that officers would gather at a bar near Dodger Stadium to celebrate their shootings, handing out red cards for a wound and black cards for a kill. Perez implicated at least 70 officers, including crash officer Nino Durden, and how he had engineered the false firearm charge against then 16-year-old Oscar Eagle. But that was a different crime, so Oscar remained behind bars for yet another crime he did not commit.
My mom died in 2007, and after her death, I went into a depression, and I couldn't snap out of it. I was grieving. I started making poor decisions. Eventually, the squad unit came in and they gaffled me up. They had searched my cell and they found my address book. I had an address to Gigi Gordon that was helping me in my case years prior. And she happened to have a client that was a member of the Mexican Mafia. And they said that I was using her as a third-party drop to connect with the Mexican Mafia. So they sent me to the hole.
You're again, like, falsely accused, and you get thrown pretty much in solitary for 6 years.
Yes. I just would think that, man, I must be cursed. You know, the nightmare just got worse and worse. And so I was like, man, you guys are just stretching. You guys are just stretching to validate me or to break me or something. And I got a visit from my dad when I was in ADSEG. That was the last time I seen him. I told him, hey, Dad, they're trying to break me in here. And yeah, he just said, oh, you know, don't break. just believe in a higher power, man. Just don't break.
You mentioned that that was the last time you saw your father because, unfortunately, both of your parents passed while you were incarcerated. What at that point kept you from giving up hope completely?
When I was in the SHU, we ended up having a hunger strike. And the result of the hunger strikes that we went through, they started to release us back to the general population. I started to see the GP as freedom, you know? So I was like, oh shit, I'm gonna go back to the mainline. I always loved running laps. So I was like, man, I could go out there and run again. You know, like I could get into school and try to get an education.
And with greater freedom of movement and access to educational materials, he was able to submit his case to the Conviction Review Unit under Jackie Lacey, the LA District Attorney at the time. But citing that it was submitted with no new evidence, he was denied a reinvestigation. So Oscar had to wait for the election of George Gascon in order to resubmit his case, around which point Megan got involved.
I was actually at a transitional house at an event for other clients, and I was approached by a couple of Oscar's friends, and they had with them an entire file full of things, and they sat me down and showed me during this party. They ended up showing me all this evidence and how Rafael Perez had admitted that they had essentially placed that false gun charge on Oscar to begin with. And what really drew me to his case was it doesn't seem that Urias ever really identified Oscar until the police pointed him to do so. So I had been working in other cases with Dr. Wickstead. He's an eyewitness identification expert, and there is a new consensus in the eyewitness identification scientific community. And I thought that Oscar's case fell perfectly in line with that. So I was gathering everything that we needed. I went to the offices of G.G. Gordon, because Gordon has passed away. I contacted all of Oscar's prior counsel and got materials from the California Court of Appeal. That all takes a lot of time to gather the materials. In the meantime, the LA District Attorney's Office, well, Oscar was blessed, I'll just say that, because there was a deputy district attorney in Los Angeles who is behind, I think, 7 exonerations now. She really believed in these cases and incorporated the eyewitness identification consensus into most of them. She has now gone on to become a judge, which is a great loss to the innocence community. But she ended up looking at the case as well. So she and I actually ended up working on the case together. We interviewed witnesses together. I flew to Northern California to interview Benjamin Urias, who was actually incarcerated at that time. I interviewed him with some attorney investigators as well. And it just seemed so clear that there was no evidence against Oscar. The only evidence was this quote unquote identification by Urias, which never existed.
Megan Baca and the DA's Habeas Corpus Litigation Office together filed a joint writ arguing that Oscar's conviction was the result of ineffective counsel for all the reasons we've already discussed. His attorney had failed to impeach Benjamin Urias or Detective Murrell with the audio recording of the flawed identification process, ignored the issue of Urias's unrelated criminal case, did not present more alibi witnesses or supporting evidence. Most critically, the defense never introduced proof of Oscar's compromised physical condition or called his doctor to testify that, given his injuries, he could not have committed this crime.
So, although the ineffective assistance of counsel is what led Oscar to be wrongfully convicted in the first place, at least that meant that some of this evidence that we were able to use to prove his innocence wasn't already used in the past so that we couldn't, you know, bring that up again post-conviction.
And relatively speaking, once you got involved, it was pretty fast.
It was really fast. And again, that is thanks to DA Laura Bazan of the LA District Attorney's Office. She was in the Conviction Integrity Unit and then went over to the Habeas Litigation Unit. And, you know, if she hadn't been working with us jointly, then this would have taken years and years.
On July 10th, 2025, Oscar's conviction was vacated.
Once he was out, we got to meet face-to-face for the first time. And now he's my next-door neighbor.
That's amazing. You know, the Los Angeles Times did basically, where are they now in terms of all the different people who contributed to this wrongful conviction. And the LAPD spokesperson had no comment on it. Others denied wrongdoing. You know, even Patrick Lake, your attorney, who claims he doesn't even remember your case. I want to ask about accountability. What does accountability mean in a case like this?
I just don't see them taking accountability. I should think like, man, I wonder sooner or later, are they going to step up and say, you know what, I did something wrong back then. You know, I got a young kid off the streets. But I'm not the only one. There's other guys still stuck in there from the Rampart scandal. I would love to see these officers have integrity and do the right things, but I don't think it's going to happen.
No matter how we hold the people responsible to account, Oscar lost his entire 20s and 30s to prison. He wasn't there when either of his parents passed away, and there's absolutely nothing to get him that time back. I think that the state bar should take these cases more seriously when there is such egregious, ineffective assistance, just simply no evidence put on that was very apparent and readily available. I also think that qualified immunity is a huge issue. I don't see how prosecutors or police can ever really be held accountable so long as there's this immunity. I also think that even all of these years later, even when district attorney's offices are willing to do the right thing and they, you know, they get so much credit from me, I'm so grateful to them. You know, even in Oscar's case, the elected DA of LA County showed up and appeared on the record in his case, which is huge. However, you know, the police still aren't held to account for the wrongdoing. And the problem is the police are the investigating agency for the district attorney's office. I mean, they work together. They work hand in hand. Police unions donate to prosecutorial elections. Aside from overhauling the system completely, I don't know how we can ever prevent this sort of thing from happening again, considering that they work so closely together.
And when people say, oh, well, there are settlements and there's money paid, that money is not coming from the people who caused the wrongful conviction. That's not accountability. That's society basically trying to pay off to protect the people in power.
Right. Right. That's coming from the taxpayers.
So with that, we're going to close out this interview by asking our audience to support Megan's organization. They're out there doing the work necessary to finally bring about some measure of justice in these cases. So we're going to link California Innocence Advocates in the episode description. Please donate, follow them on social media, or otherwise get involved. And now I'm just going to thank you both for sharing this story with us before I leave the floor to you for any final thoughts.
Yeah, I will say that I am consistently shocked by how little evidence needs to be put on for a jury to convict. I don't think that people understand the burden of beyond a reasonable doubt. And when the crime is allegedly gang motivated and they have gang investigators coming up and testifying, it just sort of scares the jury into, well, let's lock up whoever, because it sounds like, you know, the hoodlums. It's all these hoodlums out there destroying our communities, like the crash unit.
I was just about to say, like the crash unit, quote, street hoodlum.
That's right. Even though in Oscar's case, what he was doing was artwork on walls. He was doing graffiti. You know, he wasn't out shooting people, but they lump them all into being sort of the same. And that, you know, anybody that's gang associated, just having grown up in that neighborhood, they're necessarily evil and violent.
I just want to let people know that, you know, our system is bad. You know, like they don't need concrete evidence or direct evidence to find you guilty here. It's like they don't take a human life serious. You know, and I'll just tell people just to be more open-minded and look beyond somebody's image, because it's easy for a district attorney, it's easy for a police officer to draw a negative image to somebody that's on the stand. We take their word is gold. And they got to be able to see behind their words. When you make a person into a monster and an animal, it's real easy to convict them as soon as you have that thought in your mind.
Thank you for listening to Wrongful Conviction. You can listen to this and all Lava for Good podcasts 1 week early and ad-free by subscribing to Lava for Good Plus on Apple Podcasts. I'd like to thank our production team, Connor Hall and Kathleen Fink, as well as executive producers Jason Flom, Jeff Kempler, Kevin Wardis, and Jeff Clyburn. The music in this production was supplied by three-time Oscar-nominated composer Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us across all social media platforms at Lava for Good and at Wrongful Conviction. You can also follow me on Instagram at Lauren Bright Pacheco. Wrongful Conviction is a production of Lava for Good Podcast in association with Signal Company No. 1.
We have worked hard to ensure that all facts reported in this show are accurate. The views and opinions expressed by the individuals featured in this show are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of Lava for Good.